Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. My name is Chris Tidwell.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
Today, we'll be discussing a particularly pertinent topic, one of evictions and a housing crisis that is a product of the COVID-19 depression, so to speak. This will pick up on some of the themes that we've been talking about in the past, particularly pertaining to what kind of rights need to be ensured for America to progress and do better for its populace. There's obviously a history of, if you've been listening, a history that we've been trying to lay out about the crisis of rights, wherein America has largely neglected ensuring rights and has only gone for mere political and civil protections. Housing is one of these rights that we've historically ignored as a right. It's not enshrined in our Constitution. And so similar to the way that we've outlined with these other projects, what ways do you see, Richard, that housing needs to be ensured as a right? And why should we respect some of the claims that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights make about the right to housing?
Yeah, now it's important to recognize that there is a right to decent housing that is affirmed in Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1948, and we, of course, are one of the signatories to that document. But as you mentioned, our Constitution makes no mention whatsoever of the right to decent housing. But I think it's obvious that housing is something to which any individual has a fundamental right, because if we are going to uphold any of our freedoms, none are going to be freedoms that we can exercise if we don't have a place to live. And whether that place to live is something that is mobile, be it a houseboat or a trailer or a caravan or something fixed, we need a place within which we can keep our property, within which we can maintain our house and have a private space, within which we can conduct our marital and parental relationships. We need a base within which we can come back from work, from political activity, and be able to have a kind of asylum where we know that we have a space that is our own and where we are protected. And if we're stripped of any such home, then obviously all of our freedoms are in jeopardy. And when I speak of a home, we have to speak of a decent home. And that aspect of decency is to be identified in terms of what we really need in our living space in order to be able to exercise our freedoms. And today that means we need a space that has proper utilities. You know, we have to be protected against both heat and cold. We have to have broadband. We have to have other aspects of electricity and communication so that we can really exercise all of our freedoms and have any modicum of equal opportunity with others. And we need enough space to be able to conduct our household activities. The more dependents we have, the more space we need. So in all these respects, when we're talking about having a decent home, we're talking about one in which we can carry on our life in a way where we're not disadvantaged. And of course, we want to think about housing as something that is safe, that is environmentally sound, that is constructed in such a way that it contributes to a biosphere that is fully livable and that allows us actually to participate in all of our community activities.
Well, it's certainly required as an animal to be able to have some kind of nest. I mean, that's a given. But also the uniqueness of the human world, the beyond simply just a biosphere, is the ability to be a democratic participant, particularly in America. And having this housing allows us to better participate in this society. And you talked about some of these not just needs, but also wants and even thereby necessities of civil society that housing provides. You talked about broadband or something like this. Could you expand briefly on that?
I mean, I think we can see a stark disregard in the United States for the right to decent housing, the kind of housing that could be said to contribute to a democratic life in which one can really exercise all one's freedoms on a par with others. I mean, first of all, we have mass homelessness. Before the pandemic hit in full force several months ago, there were every night more than 550,000 Americans who didn't have a home. And of these 550,000 homeless people, 193,000 were actually living on the streets, completely unprotected from the elements. In each year, 1.5 million Americans undergo the trauma of homelessness. And we're talking about people of all ages. We're talking about people of all genders, all races. We're talking about children. We're talking about people who are suffering all sorts of conditions, both physical and mental. And of course, we're talking about a condition that does reflect the entrenched racial and gender disparities that have not been removed. Now, in addition to this mass homelessness that is on grim display in every American city, and anyone who lives in Athens, Georgia, a fairly small college town, will be encountering every single day homeless people on street corners. Some who are staying in shelters, and then they have to leave the shelters during the day, and then they have to go on their weary trudge through the town with no real public facilities available to them, weary, tired, etc. But in addition to that, there are 30 million American homes that have serious health and safety hazards, that are not fit for proper human habitation, that are not fit for persons to be really able to exercise all of their rights. 30 million houses, we're talking about houses that probably, I would estimate, house as many as 70 or 80 million people. Now, since the 2008 Great Recession, home ownership in the United States has declined. We used to be a world leader in the percentage of individuals who actually lived in a home of their own. Now we have fallen behind most other developed nations. At the same time, rental vacancy rates are at historic lows. But at the same time that rent vacancies are at historic lows, rents are rising faster than ever. They're outpacing income, they're outpacing inflation. And what that reflects is a situation where landlord revenues are at an all-time high as a share of our gross national product, at the same time where wages are at an all-time low as a share of our gross national product. Now, in a way, there's a connection between these two factors, that is the decline in levels of home ownership and the increase in rates of rent. Because basically, as fewer and fewer people are unable to find housing that they can own, more and more have to go into the rental market, which is driving up rental rates. And now, according to the government's own estimates, in any American city, if you're going to rent a one-bedroom apartment, you have to make at least $17.90 an hour. And if you're going to be able to rent a two-bedroom apartment, which any person who has children would need, you need to earn $22.10 an hour. And obviously, in a nation that has a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, we're talking about a grim situation where people simply cannot afford to rent. And now, in general, the median rental is at 30% of income. That is to say, half of the people who are renting apartments are spending more than 30% of their income. Now, according to the government, you are what is called rent burdened if you are spending 30% of your income on rent. You are severely burdened if you're spending 50% of your income on rent. Now, I think we need to recognize that these categories of being rent burdened and being severely burdened really are not really the appropriate categories, because what we really have to pay attention to is not what share of our income is taken up by rent, but what income we have left over to meet our other expenses. And according to the government's own figures, the average family needs $1,400 of residual monthly income to not fall into abject poverty. Well, 20% of American families have, after paying rent, no more than $500 a month to take care of all of their other expenses. And that is a recipe for severe deprivation.
Absolutely. There's an actualization of freedoms there that is stifled, blockages, like you say. If you don't have enough supplemental income besides renting, I mean, you can have a house, that's great and all, but or you can be renting a house and that's great and all, but you don't have anything extra to do with it, so to speak. But something that I'm more interested in is oftentimes people of by my age and in today's society, we're pessimistic about the future of potentially owning a house. I've been told basically since I was in high school that that's probably never going to happen. Well, if you rewind 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was almost easier definitely to try and to think about getting a house even in the 20s or early 30s. That was a much more attainable goal. And in some ways, I've been attuned to a culture that doesn't see this as necessarily a problem. But furthermore, if I'm spending so much on rent as a product of these recent economic developments, I'm not going to be able to save even beyond that. But I'm wondering if you could outline some of the differences between the housing equity, as they say it, or in owning a house, versus the contemporary situation with that, because a lot of people seem to be throwing that out the window as even a possibility to begin with.
I mean, I think there's been this kind of almost common ideology that has been incorporated in the American dream, that one wants to aspire to own a house of one's own. Now, remember, one does need a place to live that is decent, that has the space and all the amenities one needs to be able to exercise all one's rights and take care of one's family and so forth. And that can, in principle, be achieved by both renting an apartment or renting a house, and also by purchasing an apartment or purchasing a house, right? I mean, both possibilities can, in principle, provide for a fulfillment of our right to decent housing. But there is this sense that, you know, you're throwing your money away if you just rent, be it renting an apartment or renting a house. You're not building up any equity. And so there's a sense that, you know, you really want to buy something. And indeed, what might lead one to think that that is an avenue to take is that if you compare the average net worth of a United States homeowner to an average United States renter, the homeowner has a net worth of $195,400. $195,400. On average, the renter, the U.S. renter, has a net worth of only $5,400. Now, one thing to keep in mind with these figures is that today the median house cost $324,000. A couple of years ago, it was only $200,000, but it's grown up considerably. It's increased considerably. The average price of a house today is about $383,000. Well, what that tells you is that if the average owner of a home in the United States has a total wealth of $171,000, that tells you not only do they not even own the entire equity of their house, but they don't have much of anything else. And frankly, if you have to depend upon your home as the basis of your equity, you are not someone of sufficient wealth to be able to provide for your own opportunities. Those who are more affluent have as part of their wealth much more than their home ownership or their multiple homes. A much greater part of their wealth lies in other assets besides home equity. It's only people of very modest means, ultimately, who have home equity as a basis of their personal finances. And that home equity is not going to really be enough. Now, the lure of home equity can obviously be a trap. And we saw that in the 2008, Great Recession, where, through this housing bubble that was promoted by banks and finance companies offering loans to people who were not likely to be able to afford those home loans. Well, this led to a collapse of the housing market, and 10 million people lost their homes. 10 million people lost their homes. A disproportionate number of these people were people of color. And when the government under first Bush and then Obama and a Democratic-controlled Congress went to save the finance industry from collapse, they did nothing to bail out the homeowners. So what resulted was the greatest destruction of African-American wealth in our lifetime, as, 10,000 homes were lost and foreclosed upon. And then an additional 10 million homes, 10 million homes, and an additional 4 million homes have remained what you call underwater, in that the value of the house is less than the remaining debt on the mortgage. And since 2018, in addition to the 10 million people, 10 million families who lost their homes, and the 4 million who found themselves more or less going underwater financially because of the homes on which they held mortgages, almost another 6 million homes ended up, 6.3 million mortgages were lost between 2009 and 2015. So in other words, the lure of having home equity can also involve huge risks. And we have to keep that in mind when we look at the two options for fulfilling the right to decent housing. Home ownership may be looked upon as something that is going to be to the financial benefit of individuals, but that is far from necessary.
Right. And there seems to be also, for me, a certain level. You talk a lot about the 2008 crisis. This was obviously a crisis created because of freewheeling spending on a market that was thought that it couldn't fail, the mortgage crisis. And a lot of the times this sort of predatory behavior by financiers and so on falls on the burden of those who can't take it the most. Obviously, those who are at the lowest income bracket are particularly minority households. But also, in general, the financiers are the ones that wind up getting bailed out, and the working families are the ones that have to take the burden of those losses. And it seems to be evident in today's crisis that that's the current problem as well. A lot of these landlords have been coming out and saying, well, there should have been a savings account for a rainy day for these types of situations. So that brings me to a question of really who's to blame, but who do we wind up supporting, and how do we actualize those supports? Do we give certain rent forgiveness? I know there's been moratoriums that are about to end that have helped, but we've seen very few rent forgivenesses, just mostly freezes. And this also maybe gets tied in a little bit to the way that rent can be regulated, how we have to dole out these policies correctly. And could you maybe explain some of the stratums of those approaches?
Yeah, I mean, we have to recognize that, you know, we have had a housing crisis that has been mounting as the cost of housing, both rental and home ownership, have been outpacing wage growth, which has been stagnating, and inflation. And now with the COVID pandemic upon us, and with the brief moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures coming to an end at the end of this month, and with the extra unemployment insurance that the CARE bill provided also coming to an end this month, 28 million American families are going to be facing evictions and foreclosures in the coming weeks. So we are facing a tsunami of homelessness, and we want to think about the remedies. I think first we want to think about, you know, what can be done with regard to the market for rental properties and the market for homes that one can purchase. Because generally speaking, you know, if we want to ensure that people are going to have a decent dwelling, and we recognize that this can be fulfilled either through rental or through purchase of a home or condominium, we have to ensure that this is affordable to everyone. And when we think about the affordability, we have to keep in mind that the payments involved have to be such that individuals have left over enough income to be able to meet their other needs. Now, admittedly, we are in a society that has failed to fulfill our other social rights, where in order to be able to access healthcare, access education at all levels, access legal representation, we need to have money. And if we don't have sufficient money, we are going to lack these amenities that are so basic to exercising our freedom. So, for example, because we don't have Medicare for All or some other public provision that ensures that people get the medical care they need, no matter what their wealth, people find themselves unable to either rent or buy a house because of medical bills that are driving them to bankruptcy. In addition, student debt is now the second largest debt that individuals have. And it makes it impossible for people to entertain the idea of being able to purchase any kind of dwelling. They find themselves now stuck on having to find rent. But the question is, will rent be affordable? And the market, alas, cannot be relied upon, as we are all seeing in many communities in America, to provide rental spaces that are affordable, because rents are outpacing salaries, wages, as well as inflation. And in addition, with rental vacancies at an all-time low, people are not being able to find apartments or homes for rent in places where they have jobs, in places where they have family. And what that means is that many, many people who can't find affordable rentals are having to find places far, far away from where they work, far, far away from their family, far, far away from all the amenities they need. And that, of course, is not good for our environment, because this means that people have to drive inordinate distances. And of course, we are a country that has provided a pretty miserable supply of public transportation. So this is a genuine crisis. Now, there have been two broad kinds of remedies to deal with the problem of rents, rental rates being unaffordable. And the first was instituted on a broad scale in many, many nations after World War I. And it's the idea of rent control. And rent control was introduced after World War I because, particularly in Europe, you had massive destruction of apartments and housing dwellings. The supply was diminished. Prices were rising like crazy. And you had all sorts of decommissioned soldiers returning and needing housing. So there was a great shortage. It was shooting rents sky high. And there was a need for some kind of public control. And the idea is that you had to set a limit on how high rents could be. You know, they had to be such that people could afford to pay them and have enough income left over to meet their other basic needs. Now, I myself have experienced rent control. I spent a number of years living in Manhattan before coming to the University of Georgia. And New York City has a fairly large rent control system where many, many apartments are under strict rent control, meaning that landlords are not allowed to raise the rent very much. And I've also been going to India after having married my wife, who's from Calcutta. And Calcutta has very strict rent control. And one of the problems with rent control is that if the rent control is set too low, then landlords may not have sufficient resources to maintain apartments. And you see this very on grim display in Calcutta, where much of the housing stock is incredibly dilapidated. And when I speak the housing stock, this applies to everything outside the front door of an apartment, the hallways, the outside, the sidewalks, the exterior of the building. Inside the apartments, people may be able to take care of it themselves, provided they have sufficient income. But the rents are kept so low that the landlord simply cannot keep up with increasing costs. So what does this lead to? It also leads to great difficulty in finding vacant apartments, where in order to get an apartment, there's going to be a black market. You have to make payments under the table. And also people will not be willing to put housing stock for rent because the rentals are so low. You have this problem in New York. Many people find that when they're looking for housing, they have to make payments under the table to get a place. Now, there was a move to try to deal with the problem of rent control that's too rigid, too low. And that was the idea of a second version called rent stabilization, where there were limits set on how much rents could be raised. But these limits were set by having negotiations over what were the costs that landlords had to bear in order to maintain apartments. So there was a little bit more flexibility. But nevertheless, there were restraints, and I myself was living in a rent-stabilized apartment in Manhattan, which was quite cheap. I wouldn't say it was in the greatest of shape, but it was decent enough, and it was incredibly reasonable, given what happens in the real estate market when you're dealing with new units that are added, because then the market will be such that landlords can offer new units at whatever the market will bear. And that can be much, much more than what rent-stabilized apartments are on offer for. And then there's also a move, as we all know, for landlords in cities that have either rent control or rent stabilization to take apartments out of rental circulation when they get vacated and try to transform them into condominiums that are sold. And that way they can make huge profits. So we have to take into account that if we want to be able to keep some kind of lid on rents, we need to set limits, at least on the lower end of the market, that are going to be sufficient to take care of maintenance costs. Because if we pitch rent stabilization or rent control too low, then buildings will not be maintained. Then you will have a black market where you have to make all sorts of underhanded payments, which in a way defeats the whole idea of using rent stabilization to have affordable apartments. And then you will have an insufficient supply of rental units. So this is sort of the dilemma you face when you deal with a market of privately owned apartments and realize that the dynamics of competition can drive apartment rents sky high so that they are not affordable. And that can be very detrimental to the very fabric of a community. But if you want to rely upon rent controls or rent stabilization, you have to recognize that you can't set it too low. Now, one way of course, dealing with this problem is to eliminate poverty income. And if we fulfill our right to employment at a fair wage with a federal job guarantee that wipes out unemployment, that sets up the tightest labor market, that involves a fair minimum wage starting on at least $20 an hour, and if we, in addition, include a $900 per month child allowance, then people will have sufficient income to rent apartments at the lower end of the market in most American cities. And in this way, if we were to deal with our current crisis, where we're facing mass unemployment of a degree that we have never experienced in our lifetime, if we can put people to work by instituting a federal job guarantee or maintaining payrolls or providing replacement income for those who cannot work, that is sufficient to pay rents that are at least stabilized in a way that allows landlords to maintain buildings, then we can avoid having to have rent strikes. But on the other hand, I think one measure that we have to think about as a permanent measure is to end evictions and foreclosures and utility turnoffs and ensure that no one suffers the trauma of being thrown out of a home or having to live in an apartment or a house with no electricity, no broadband, because you can't make the payments. And if we ensure that everyone has a steady stream of reasonable income, then we can have mandatory rescheduling of payments.
And that seems certainly pertinent to the problem right now. And what I guess is nice and also really convincing about the arguments that you're laying forward is that it's both beneficial for the individual, the renter, and the landlord as well, that it would also help them. And I think that's interesting, to say the least, but also it could be good for even its promotion of business, right? So that's beneficial for both sides.
We also have to think about how can we make homeownership something that is more broadly available and affordable by regulating the market.
Right.
And, you know, we have as a nation had public policies that have favored homeownership and left renters sort of, relatively disadvantaged. One example of that is the mortgage tax deferment, whereby you can subtract the amount of money you pay on mortgage payments from your taxable income. Well, this obviously gives a subsidy to people who have mortgages on homes that they have purchased, whereas no comparable relief is given to given to people who make outlays for rent. But one thing one has to recognize in terms of trying to make housing purchase for purchase more affordable is that, you know, in America, most people who are going to purchase a house are going to rely upon borrowing money. And the possibility of getting a mortgage is going to be relative to how much of a down payment you have to put in order to have to obtain a mortgage. Also, how high the monthly premiums will, as well as, you know, how long the mortgage will be. You know, the longer the mortgage, the smaller the premiums can be, the monthly payments. If it's a shorter mortgage, then the payments can be much higher because you're trying to pay out the premium in a shorter period of time. But the affordability of a mortgage is going to be based upon, in a sense, how large a down payment is, how long the mortgage will be, and also what the interest rates are. Now, we have had various policies that have been instituted to try to make mortgages more affordable. Now, these policies have been used on a mass scale, and they've been used in a way that has been discriminatory to African Americans and other people of color. This has been true of the Veterans Administration home loans, which were given out on a mass scale after the Second World War. And millions of homes, in fact, about half of the stock of homes built in the post-war years, were in a sense homes that people managed to buy getting a subsidized mortgage from the Veterans Administration. But African Americans were to a large degree shunted out of this program. The same thing applied to Federal Housing Authority loans and Federal Housing Authority mortgage insurance. It's not only the mortgage that can be subsidized, but also mortgage insurance, because what mortgage insurance does is it protects the lender in the case that the person who pays the mortgage might default. But this way, the lender is not going to collapse. So the Federal Housing Authority gave out huge amounts of subsidized mortgages and home insurance. And this fueled the huge development of suburbanization that took place after the Second World War. Again, it discriminated to a large degree against African Americans, and this was compounded by the practice of redlining, where private banks would avoid providing mortgage loans to residents in disproportionately minority communities, which made it less possible for African Americans and other people of color to participate in this great wave of new home ownership. And by the way, this building of homes with government-subsidized mortgages and mortgage insurance plans was far and away the greatest infrastructure project of the post-war epoch. I mean, it was something really very vast. But what did it do? You know, it left people in the cities, and particularly minorities, stuck in rental properties in cities from which others were able to escape on the road to taking advantage of a post-war economic boom. And it left cities, in a sense, centers of urban decay and increased impoverishment. At the same time, it led to all the dislocations of suburbanization, where we embarked on a kind of development which involved low density, meaning we had these separated individual single-family housing units, which involved, on the one hand, single-use communities of suburban sprawl, separated from schools, separated from workplaces, separated from cultural communities, separated from parks. And that involved not only a kind of racial segregation, because minorities were left in the cities, by and large, it also involved a certain kind of age segregation. Because here we were talking about a kind of housing development that particularly applied to younger people with families and the like. And in all these respects, it led to a kind of development that was not something that fostered community involvement. It certainly was not good for the environment because it involved much more fossil fuel consumption. It also involved much higher infrastructure costs because you had to lay out much longer utility lines. You had to build all of these roads, etc. And, you know, we find something similar in the way in which we've developed our countryside in more rural areas. And if you go to other parts of the world and you go to rural settlements, there'll be villages, there'll be hamlets where houses are concentrated together. Then you have the fields and the expanse, the agricultural land spreading out beyond. But in the United States, we have individual homes far apart from one another, which involves, again, a kind of disassociation of people, which makes it not only more expensive to deal with all of the utilities and involves much more fossil fuel consumption, but it also leaves people stranded because we don't have public transportation in our rural areas. So what happens if you can't afford to have a car or for health reasons you're no longer able to drive? You can't go to the stores that are far away or to doctors that are far away or to friends or to religious institutions. You know, this is a kind of development that has a lot of drawbacks. And the housing policy we followed that sort of subsidized suburban sprawl had a similar kind of effect. And then what happened in the inner cities? Well, the urban decay reached such a magnitude that it was evident that something had to be done. But what was to be done? The market was not itself sufficient to deal with the problems. And I think we want to look at two options that have been followed. One has to do with so-called social housing, where private, particularly nonprofit organizations, try to in a way, remedy the shortcomings of the marketplace with regard to both single-family housing and apartments to some degree. And then there's the other option of public housing, where our government actually tries to deal with the supply of housing units by building them on its own and not simply regulating the market. And I think it's worthwhile to look at what has been done on both fronts.
While the coronavirus is often seen as a real negation of these problems and helped accelerate some of the already existing inequities, there's also a possibility for it to realign some of the cultural geography that you're talking about. In fact, the way that people talk about the Great Depression is that it sort of reinvigorated some of the public works program, and hopefully there's a possibility to take advantage of that here. So I was wondering in particular what kind of, you're already sort of getting at it, but what kind of programs exactly would work? I mean, there's the idea of an insurance possibility or reestablishing a stronger public housing, but that would be the...
Well, yeah, I think before we take up public housing, we should look at the what so-called social housing can do, what private initiatives can do to try to supplement the for-profit marketplace. And here in Athens, we have, you know, two rather vigorous movements along these lines. You know, we have Habitat for Humanity. It's headed by Spencer Fry, who happens to be our one Democratic representative in the State House in Georgia, because the Republicans who control districting have carved up Athens into three different districts, only one of which has a strong Democratic majority. Well, he's in charge of Habitat for Humanity, and Habitat for Humanity, as you may know, attempts to help people of modest incomes to be able to obtain a home of their own. And it does it through what they call sweat equity, where they ask the families who are going to participate in the program to actually put in labor in helping to build the home, or alternately to also repair homes that are in need of repair. Now we have another organization, which is part of the Community Land Trust Movement. It's the Athens Land Trust Movement, and they have a different strategy, but somewhat analogous. They attempt to expand home ownership to people of modest incomes by offering for sale an affordable, low-cost house at a low rate, at a very reasonable mortgage. But the individuals do not buy the property. The property remains owned by the land trust. Instead, the individuals who buy the house, they acquire a home equity, which grows as they pay their mortgage. But they are required, if they're going to move, to sell the house back to the land trust. And they will receive a payment that will be something that will allow them to have earned back their equity and come away with a reasonable gain. But it will ensure that the house is now available for resale to someone else at a modest price with a modest mortgage that once again will not involve ownership of the land. Now, these are all, in a way, admirable efforts to attempt to supplement the failures of the market. But we have to recognize that they're modest. I mean, even though they are what we might consider large nonprofit organizations, their achievements have a scale that really makes it obvious that much more is needed. Habitat for Humanity in 2017 built 16,832 homes. They repaired 13,804 others. Well, that sounds like a significant amount. But the need for housing in the United States is in the millions. The same thing applies to the Community Land Trust Movement. In 2018, it provided homes to 18,946 families. But we have 1.5 million people who experience homelessness every year. We have 28 million families who are going to be facing eviction or foreclosure at the end of this coming month. Private nonprofit efforts have a limit. They cannot be counted on to fulfill rights, because rights require, in a sense, a guarantee. If you have a right to housing, if we're going to recognize that right, that means that we guarantee you a decent home. Well, private nonprofits do not have unlimited resources, but our government can tap the entire resources of the nation. It can use its fiscal autonomy to make the kind of public investments necessary. And that means in the last resort, as a last resort, the government can step in to provide both affordable rental properties and affordable homes for purchase. To make up for the problems in supply.
Certainly exacerbated that. I mean, it's putting absolute strain on all these public or even private endeavors to try and rectify the problem. I mean, like you're saying, there's about to be a flooding of these, the same way unemployment's been flooded, these avenues. I think I think that's a really important point to note, that when these systems fall, despite the problems of the landlords not being able to collect or something like that, it also falls on the government and these other private entities. They have to spend more too when somebody gets kicked out of their home. They have to go to a homeless shelter, and that's even more problematic in today's situation where everybody has to wear masks and be cautious about the spread of the virus in general, and homeless shelters aren't equipped to be able to facilitate that, thereby putting more strain on the hospitals or testing centers or something like that. So there's this chain reaction. I mean, it's the definition of a collapse on itself.
I think you can see that in a way, the need for public investment in housing to guarantee decent housing to everyone is something that has to be recognized, even if we succeed in providing full employment and a decent income to everyone, because that of itself does not guarantee that there will be an adequate supply of decent housing. Now, unfortunately, when there has been direct public construction of housing units, it's taken the form of what goes by the name euphemistically of urban renewal. And what that has meant is the destruction of communities in cities, often of minority communities, and the building of huge apartment blocks, which end up become warehouses of the poor, because they are open exclusively to people of very low income. They're not mixed developments. And they're built as, in a sense, single-use communities, where all you have is this gigantic residential complex, isolated from workplaces, cultural institutions, parks, shops, and everything else that can give vitality to a community. And of course, often urban development that involves slicing cities up through the construction of expressways instead of developing proper public transportation has led to a further kind of geographic isolation of these public housing complexes, which, given the way in which they're built without either remedying the poverty and unemployment that has led to urban decay in large measure. Well, you know, we've seen that many of these housing developments have had to be turned down because they've ended up being hell holes.
Like Pruitt-Igoe is the constant example. I mean, that.
So you know, other countries have thought of public housing in a completely different way. They, first of all, have thought of it as being something that would involve people of all sorts of income levels, of all sorts of ages. They've constructed these housing developments in terms of much smaller units that are combined with all sorts of multi-use developments so that they're not isolated from workplaces or from schools or from shopping areas or from cultural institutions or from public transportation. And there's been attention paid to green development. And then the same thing has applied to what kind of public investment has been made in single-family housing to the extent that one wants to have any such development. Well, there's been a recognition that one wants to think of building units that have a higher density, partly so that people can engage in community activities and not be separated from other parts of the community, that they can be near workplaces, they can be near public transportation, can be near various cultural institutions and the like, and that one can construct, you know, a completely different fabric of life. There's a whole new movement of so-called new urbanism that is recognizing that we have to think seriously about how we want to redevelop communities so that we have bikeable, walkable communities, communities where people of all ages, of all races, of all ethnic groups, of all income levels are living in proximity with one another and thereby able to share in the same amenities and thereby really have something much more like the same opportunities. And obviously we are facing a climate crisis and we have to completely rethink how we are structuring our communities. Obviously, we can replace fossil fuel vehicles with electric vehicles and then try to make a conversion of electricity production to renewable energy. You know, that is not technologically impossible. But we also want to think about, you know, reconstructing communities so that they foster the kind of interactions which are those that we want a democratic society to have. And I think public investment in housing, both in cities, in suburbs, in rural areas, provides us with an opportunity to rethink how we want to construct our communities, to foster the opportunities of everyone, to foster a truly livable environment that will be green. And to provide the kind of walkable, bikeable living space in which we can escape the kind of isolation that is plaguing America.
Absolutely. I hope there is a sort of cultural reawakening behind something like that, which is characteristically a modernist idea, but hopefully we can center around this. But
now keep in mind that we can make these kind of public investments in truly decent housing by making use of a federal job guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are in a situation as we are today, with unparalleled levels of unemployment, where tens of millions of people are without work, and where tens of millions of people, 28 million households, are facing homelessness, we need to get people to work and right. begin providing for the kind of homes that can overcome our deficits in supply, wipe out homelessness once and for all, and really ensure that everyone has a decent roof over their heads. Because if you don't have a home, you can't come back, take care of your family, have respite from work and political engagement, and be able to live a life that is genuinely free and independent.
One thing I'm just a little bit curious about, the developers of today are particularly interested in this sort of mixed living development zones. And that could be a product of some sort of government project as well. And, you know, it's sort of cornily, it's like a corny way to refer to it, but it's like live, eat, play zones, yeah. so to speak. These are extremely yeah. popular in the yeah. and they're known as almost the architecture of the future. It's some of the most popular developments even here in Athens right now for those wanting to spend money in the private sector. Is something like that where you wake up in the morning to a well-subsidized house or a well rent-controlled house. You go downstairs to your federally guaranteed job. You know what I mean? And then you're able to go get the grocery store to the grocery store below that.
And you're not going bankrupt because of medical bills or because you're trying to get education
right
at a higher level. And we have forgiven your student debts. By the way, there's another obstacle that we haven't discussed, and that is zoning.
Right.
Because in conjunction with this expansion of suburbanization and the urban renewal that has been a recipe for urban decay, all of this is preceded under strict zoning regulations that really segregate what can be built in different areas. And you know, if we are going to have multi-use developments, and by the way, Jane Jacobs was one of the earliest writers to really make a very strong case for why we have to overcome these single-use developments and have mixed-use developments, which allow for the full wealth of life to be vibrantly at hand in close proximity to every resident. Well, we have to overcome the zoning regulations that, on the one hand, restrict areas to single-family houses that also require houses to be of a certain size, namely a size that is going to basically shut out people of modest incomes. You know, we have to rethink our zoning policies. And I have to say this, that, you know, a lot of us had great hopes for our newly elected city government in Athens, you know, who all... By and large, we have a new majority that seems to be very interested in really fulfilling the social rights agenda, but their hands are really tied behind their backs by limitations from the state government. But one thing they can do, they can control zoning. So they can think about how to creatively rezone Athens so that we really can provide a walkable, bikeable, green, livable environment that will not allow gentrification to destroy neighborhoods and the fabric of our life, but to instead think of an architecture for freedom, an architecture for a genuinely democratic community.
Right, and avoiding these strange conglomerates of gerrymandering on a local level. It's not a gerrymandering in a voting aspect, but gerrymandering in a zoning aspect, which would mean that you have these strange outlines of different. Strange outlines of different zonings that make only sense to those who have some sort of financial gain from them.
And I think we all know that there is obviously a racial character to the kinds of housing disadvantages that are rampant in our community.
Exactly.
I mean, it's obvious if you go out anywhere in our territory, you know, you can take a look, and when you come across neighborhoods with smaller, dilapidated houses, with streets that are not as well kept, at least in Georgia, you can relatively be certain that you're dealing with a community that is either African American or involves people of color. I mean, there are similar communities, obviously, that involve people who are white, and we have to remember that even though the poverty rate of African Americans is three times that of whites, there are five times as many whites as there are African Americans. There are more poor whites in America than there are poor African Americans or poor Hispanics. And the problems of housing is a problem that afflicts all parts of our community. And we have to stand up and fulfill the right to housing sooner than later. And now we are in a perfect storm where the crisis is so acute. We have to make the really bold public investments to overcome the limitations of the housing market and ensure that everyone has a roof over their heads and end homelessness once and for all. And of course, that's bound up with healthcare, because in order to be able to maintain a home, whether it's a rental property or something that you own, you have to be healthy in mind and body. And only insofar as we fulfill our right to health care as well as our right to a livelihood, are we really going to be able to fulfill the right to housing?
Well, thank you very much for the talk today. As always, it's nice to see how these different pieces come together to create an arc of a new social bill of rights. I'm really excited about this idea of geography playing so at the core of what we've been talking about, and I look forward to our discussions next week.
Yeah, I mean, I hope people are ready for the idea of not just a job guarantee, but a decent housing guarantee. Mm-hmm. No one deserves homelessness or the threat of eviction, foreclosure, or utility turnoffs.
Particularly today.
Yeah. When you have to be able to shelter at home.
Right.
If we can't control this crazy pandemic due to the irresponsibility of our leadership.